Welcome to Conversations here on WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua, a one-hour radio show where we converse. My guest today is my brother, Mr. Norbert Nix. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah.
It's good to be here.
Yeah.
Good to see your face.
Well, it's good to see your face, too.
Yeah. Yes.
It's been a while.
It has been a while.
Norbert grew up with me in La Crosse. He's about 10 years older and pursued a career in music. So we're going to talk about the music industry, among other things, today. But let me ask, what was it like growing up in La Crosse in the 1970s?
Oh, it was perfect. It was perfect. La Crosse in the 70s is really this microcosm of creativity that I witnessed. I remember seeing, off the top of my head, people like George McEwen, who was in a band called Nexus, and they were a three-piece band, and they emulated Jimi Hendrix and Eric Clapton and all of that music, and they were blues-oriented and just powerful live. And I think about that now, and I think, man, if I knew then what I know now in terms of the business, oh, my God, these guys were just amazing. And George was flawless guitar player and just a technician and one of the best guitar players I have ever seen in my life. And he was playing at the Golden Garter on 3rd Street.
Good.
And we went in there, and it was just crazy. But anyway, that was the creative scene around La Crosse during then. There was a lot of great bands, a lot of young musicians that were playing classic rock music. And to this day, they still do that. You know, there's still bands that exist that keep doing this.
And how old were you when you first got to see a live band like that in La Crosse?
Well, back then, the fake IDs weren't very good, but they didn't look very good, but they got us in at about 17 or 18 years old, and the legal drinking age was 18. So, you know, I guess 17, 18 years old, I would see some of this stuff for the first time and see these live bands and, just kind of be blown away by the music that was around here. There were a lot of bands back then. There was a guy named Lindy Shannon, God rest his soul, that was a booking agent, and he hustled the La Crosse scene in the surrounding area, and he booked our band, Phoenix. He booked us and a bunch of different bands. I actually have an original flyer of his that he would send out. And, that's why there was a live scene, because people like him, just jamming and making the scene happen.
Yeah.
It was cool.
And when did you pick up your first guitar, and how did that happen?
Oh, good question. I guess I, Sally Prendergast, who lived up the street, had a guitar, and I bought a Con from Larry's Music, man, the six-string Con at 16, and I got a Mel Bay chord book, and then the song If by Bread. And I learned that song, and I just thought, oh, this is really cool, man. You put your fingers here, you put these chords together, you get little blisters on your finger, and, they turn into calluses, and you can play a couple more songs. And so that's when it happened, and it was kind of fun, man, and we just kind of went from there,
And tell me about your first band. Was that Phoenix?
Yeah, it was Phoenix, yeah. I don't know. Well, this is interesting. This is our 50th year of being together. We're celebrating 50 years, on and off. We've done reunions through the years. But, we started way back. I auditioned for the band at Dan Sobranek's house. And I saw them for the first time down in front of Doorflingers on a trailer with Steve Hoffman singing lead and Dave Broeker on bass and Dave Soley on drums and Dan Sobranek on guitar. And they were a four-piece, and they wore these white patch jean suits with little roses on the lapel. And I saw them, and I thought, oh, these guys are fresh. They were so good doing Steve Miller, and all these classic rock songs. And then Steve Hoffman left the band, and I had heard somebody told me, oh, they need a lead singer. So I guess I fancied myself as a lead singer, and I didn't even know what it was. I didn't even know if I could sing. And so I went and saw them again at the Golden Garter as a three-piece, and I talked to them after, and then I went and auditioned at their house, and they went into a room, a bedroom, and deliberated whether or not I would make the job, and they came out, and I got the gig. So it was fun. So we started then, and we just started playing high schools around here. And, you know, we've been doing it. We're playing with the Remainders at Moon Tunes in August. We're playing with them, and that's Andy Tempty and those guys. They're a great band. But anyway, that's kind of how that started, and it just keeps evolving. But it's ironic because the evolution includes songs that never change. So it's the same set list a lot, you know. But
50 years of playing Pinball Wizard.
Oh, my God. Can't forget that one.
So then somehow early in that time period, you met Bill Miller, Native American singer-songwriter, and played with him and were on his first record. Tell me about that.
Yeah, Bill. He's just phenomenal, Bill. I love Bill. Yeah, Bill... you know, I was playing with Dan Sobranek, and then he and I, he met Bill first and then started playing with Bill. And then I joined them, and we became Bill Miller and Native Sons. And we did Bill's first album together, and we did a lot of touring. We did the NACA college circuit and played all over the country. And, you know, Bill is, again, one of these humans that supremely talented and just spiritual and one of the best songwriters that I've ever heard. You know, I mean, you don't have to hear it from me. He's a Grammy Award winning, you know, artist. So, but Bill Miller, and still is just this, every time he opens his mouth and sings and plays guitar, it comes from somewhere, and it is just, you know, it is just powerful, powerful stuff when you hear him play. He's so passionate about his music. But yeah, we had a good time doing that, man. That was one of the first times I, was in a recording studio, really. You know, he said, "Hey, man, we're making a record." And we went over there and put the headphones on and started recording some guitar parts. And I guess I didn't know enough of it to be nervous about it. So it turned out pretty well.
You know? And where was that? La Crosse?
Yeah, that was La Crosse. La Crosse, one of these guys at a local studio, you know. So that was good. Turned out really well. That first album is still, I listen to it sometimes. It's a great record.
It really is. It needs to be repressed, yep. For sure.
Yes. Some of those songs need to be recut, actually, by other artists because they're that good. You know, he's such a great, great writer.
Yeah. So was he the first Native American person you had met? And that whole scene or that whole ideology, was that influential in your upbringing at all at that point?
Yeah, he's probably the second one that I was had a reference to. The first one was One-Eyed Decora, which, yes, we'll talk a little bit about you for 5 seconds, but as you were a child, we would drive up by the bluff and you would, what was it, One-Eyed Decora was... what was it? The bluff where the Native American person... anyway, the story. That's the second reference is Bill Miller, yes. And, you know, Bill came from the northern tribe.
Stockbridge.
Stockbridge Muncie. Mm-hmm. Right. And, yeah, it was the first time I'd ever had that experience. And it was wonderful because we would play some reservations. We went out west and played... you know, went to these reservations and played music, and it was amazing, just the experience of being in that environment. And so he introduced me to all of that, yeah.
And when did you figure out that you wanted to be in this this industry, the larger industry, and not just a musician?
Yeah, great question. You know, I think it was back then, in the 70s, there was no music business school or music business anything. You know, there was no classes or anybody mentoring. I remember back then it was when you made a record like Bill Miller did, you had to pay for it. You had to go into a studio. You had to have musicians. You had to do all of this stuff. And then you had to, you know, press the record and try to get it distributed some way. But nowadays, you know, everybody does it on their laptop and you can put it out the same day you make the song and it goes, you know, global. So the difference back then is I didn't know, you know, that you could, well, it wasn't easy back then. What you did was you had to have a record deal. You had to have an A&R guy somewhere come and see you or sign the band. And that was kind of this, you know, this distant, far off, you know, thing that people couldn't attain. They couldn't touch it. They couldn't see it. It was just this thing. Maybe you'll get a record deal. You know, was a thing. So I thought it was intriguing. I thought it was fascinating. And I would look at the albums and I would look at the names and the producers and the record companies. And I would try to figure out, just think about, what does that mean? How did these people do this? And eventually I moved to Nashville and again, Bill Miller, thank him. He was the first guy to say, hey man, you need to go to Nashville. And I thought, well, I don't like country music, but again, I knew nothing about country music because I never listened to country music, but you know, making that statement, I actually ended up to love country music. You know, and so I went down there and, you know, had a music business career. It started back then, but I figured it out when I was here, loving music and figuring out, you know, how could I be involved in this? And it kind of just by chance happened. There was no master plan, you know.
And so you went to Nashville. How old were you then?
I was 28.
Wow.
Yeah, I was working, playing, you know, in some bands and playing music and had a job and then, you know, really needed to get away, needed to get out. And Bill called and I went and I stayed down there for 6 months. I stayed with him and interned for a company called Century City Artists Management, which was at the time the biggest country music artist management company in the world. They managed, you know, like Dwight Yoakam, and we were working with Michael Martin Murphy and the Desert Rose Band, which is Chris Hillman, who was in the Byrds and the Flying Burrito Brothers and Manassas with Stephen Stills. And they put a band together, and my job at this company was to be their day-to-day manager and go on the road with them as their everything. I ran sound. I did the whole thing. And I did not know that Chris Hillman was who he was. I had no idea. And again, the same experience going into a studio, not knowing, you know, ignorance is bliss, right? So I didn't know. And I would see these people come backstage with these Manassas records and these Byrds records and these albums. And they, you know, I was leading them into the meet and greet. And I would like think, what are these records? And I'd look down and I thought, oh my God. Okay, I get it. So, you know, and these guys were just lovely. You know, there was never a show about being a rock star, but they were super talented. They were a country band. They had a number of hits on country radio. They were signed to Curb Records. And that was my first foray into this thing. And then, you know, I got into artist management. And then the company, Century City Artist Management, was owned by Jim Halsey, who was a booking agent. Who had the Jim Halsey Company, which was the biggest, largest country music booking agency in the world. He worked with everybody, Waylon Jennings, you know, the Judds, Tammy Wynette, you know, all those people, on and on, the iconic list of artists. And so I started working as an agent for them as well. I started booking Waylon Jennings and Tammy Wynette and all those people and met them and was on the road with them. And interesting stuff, man, when I look back at it, you know, one of these things you just get thrown into and you don't plan it, but when you look back at it, you think, oh, it was magical. It was really interesting and you know, lovely to be involved in that world, you know, that whole space.
And the industry must have just changed so much in the last 30, 40 years.
Yes, yes, it has. I mean, right in front of our eyes every day it changes. You know, change from when I got into it, you know, it was all vinyl, it was albums, it was cassettes, it was, you know, big block, you know, kind of the big Walmarts. Well, I don't know if they weren't around then, but it was the, you know, the stores that sold the product, you know, so you'd have to have a big hit on the radio and you'd have to, then it would translate into sales and it would translate into consumption. And that's the only way. And then the touring, of course, but there was no digital anything, which was interesting. There were no computers, you know, 1986 is when I was there. Just the advent, I think, of the computer, right? So, yeah, so all of that has changed from that world to the now world, you know.
And so Chris Hillman was probably one of the first stars that you got to hang out with.
Yes, that I didn't know, you know, that he was a star. But yeah, it was pretty cool. They were really gracious to me. I was the other guy in the band was Herb Peterson, and he was a vocalist. He played, he sang on a lot of the Jackson Browne and the Eagles stuff, and he, California musician, you know. And they would sit backstage, and they would warm up before a show, and they'd be playing. He and Chris would be playing the Leuven Brothers, like some stuff. And I, you know, now when I think about that, I was just back there running around. I'm listening to them, but I'm thinking now, oh my gosh, you know, this is just legendary.
Yeah.
Looking at these two guys.
Yeah.
And I'm just standing with them. I'm traveling with them. I'm doing all this, and I don't know if I appreciate it as much as I do now. You know. But yeah, Chris was fantastic. He's still going, man. He's still going. I figured out years later the irony, being in Phoenix, you know, the rock band Phoenix, that he wrote the song "So You Want to Be a Rock and Roll Star." I'm like, hey, we got to learn that song. I never knew it. I never knew that he wrote that song until years later.
That's hilarious.
Yeah.
So how else has the music industry changed besides like just the analog to digital thing?
Yeah.
Obviously, you have the internet and Spotify and all this sort of digital marketing where they're not tracking the vinyl sales so much, I would think, as the plays on Spotify now.
Yeah, that's right. You know, the vinyl thing is making a comeback. Believe it or not, it was gone for a long time, and now the younger generation finds it's you know, it's cool. There are turntables now that you can, you know, digital kind of turntables, you know, all that stuff. But it's changed in the regard to that. Back when I was working for Mercury Records in the 90s, it was all about getting hits on the radio. It was all about, you know, Shania Twain. You know, we had, you know, a couple songs. Nobody knew who she was, and all of a sudden one just busted open because of a video. CMT, you know, it would cost a couple $100,000 to make a music video back then because it was such a driver, right? The visual part of that combined with the radio, terrestrial radio reach, would create these stars, you know, and then people would go to the store. They couldn't get it anywhere else. They had to go buy the product. So back then, you were selling millions of records, you know, double diamond albums, you know, 10 million records sold. And, you know, and that kept going for through the 90s. It was just a phenomenal time for music. Billy Ray Cyrus, Kentucky Headhunters. I worked with Johnny Cash. You know, that was just crazy. And so what has changed is, you know, when we started Triple Tigers Records in, 2016, it was still that way. Country radio is still a huge driver. But from then to now, it still is a driver, but you can't, you know, you have a tough time attaining a playlist spot on the radio unless you have that digital mark, that footprint, unless you have a few million streams here or there, or 20 million streams, you know, whatever it is. You have to have a social media footprint, you know, Spotify, DSP footprint. You have to be scanning in order to, for these major labels to pick you up. There's a lot of indie labels that are doing, you know, doing great things nowadays too, but that's kind of how it's changed too, is now it's all about the social media. These young kids are masters at it. They know how to navigate that landscape. I work with a kid named Sawyer Utah. He's from La Crosse, and he's really the only artist I work with right now, because I'm kind of semi-retired, but I guess I'm not. But he knows the whole thing. He will post, you know, he'll edit, he'll shoot content, he'll edit it, he'll post it. He knows the metrics behind it. And then at the same time, these guys are masters of their domain. He's a producer, he's a writer, he's a singer, he's an artist. So you have to have all of that encompassed today in order to do the job.
All right. Well, that ends our first portion of this interview. And we'll take a little break for a station ID and be back. I'm talking today with my older brother, Norbert Nix, from the music industry. And most well-known around the area as the guitarist and lead singer for the band Phoenix. We'll be back. We're back, and you're listening to Conversations on WDRT 91.9 FM in Viroqua. I'm talking today with my older brother, Norbert Nix, about his recollections in the music industry and being a musician for the last, well, 50 years or so. We were talking about Nashville, and some of the musicians you've been working with. You did, what, 10 years at Mercury Records?
Yes. Yes, I was really fortunate to be involved at a very interesting time. It was explosive. It was this, you know, creative time when, you know, discovery. People were discovering these new artists, and it was a time when, for instance, I was booking the Kentucky Headhunters, who were this band out of Glasgow, Kentucky, who, you know, sounded like Led Zeppelin meets Hank Williams. And sonically, they performed their instruments like Led Zeppelin would. They had these, you know, Fender amps with these Les Pauls and Strats and just pounded out this rock and roll. But then they had this very, you know, Kentucky country boy thing. And the blend of that was, you know, it just caused this reaction out there, this kind of viral reaction where they become very popular. I started booking them in clubs all over the place, and then they were on Mercury. And so that was my entry to Mercury. I had an interview with some of those people, and they hired me as a regional promotion guy. So I moved to Chicago, and I had like 60 radio stations in the Northeast and the Midwest, and I would call them every day, and I would, you know, ask them to play our records. It was promotion, right? And so the Kentucky Headhunters had a few hits, and then they turned into quite a force out there on the road. And then that turned into, you know, Billy Ray Cyrus was, you know, just some guy from Flatwoods, Kentucky, you know, and he had this record, you know, Some Gave All, and he made this record. And it just, Achy Breaky Heart, out of nowhere, for some reason, just became a phenom. It just went multi-platinum, and he was a global superstar. And I was on the road with him. I was just traveling all over with him. It was just great to see. Same thing happened to Shania at the same time. It just kind of blew up. So there was this very special time where, you know, and I will say, ironically, at the same time, Johnny Cash was signed to Mercury, and he had a record that we put out. It was called Wanted Man, and it was a single, and he had a deal, and we couldn't get him on the radio because Johnny Cash back then, you know, wasn't cool. He was kind of like this artist that, you know, had gotten to a certain point in his career. And so they dropped him because, you know, the Shania Twain's, Billy Ray, all this stuff was happening. So we dropped Johnny Cash, and I couldn't believe that. And I didn't know at that time, but I thought, oh, that's interesting. And then, you know, then he found Rick Rubin, and then the rest is history there. But that's how the time was. It was more about discovery and not so much about these artists who later, Johnny Cash, you know, became this iconic legendary, you know, artist, you know. But it was not to be then. It was something else. So that happened for 10 years, and you know, we had that ride for that long. And then I got back into artist management at that point, you know. But yeah, the Mercury thing was really fun. It was a time of, you know, great accomplishments. You know, we were really breaking artists. There was artist development happening. We were on the road with these artists, you know, and they were learning how to be artists, how to do interviews, how to commit to their craft, how to, you know, it's not just about getting on stage every night and singing, you know, it's about everything. It's about the major commitment and the work involved in making a career. Because it's a bell curve, you know, you go up and you come down, and that's the way these artists, you know, careers happen. But back then, you know, they wrote it for a long time.
Was that the first sort of huge song, gold record, that you were involved in with Billy Ray Cyrus and Achy Breaky Heart?
Yeah, it was the first, you know, thing that I've ever seen like that. I'd never seen anything explode like that. I've never seen that kind of meteor success happening, in that period of time. I mean, it always takes time for things to happen and for hits to go and for artists to become legends. But that was instant. So it was very interesting how that happened. And then, you know, when that happens, then you think, oh, well, let's do this again and let's do this again. And then it kind of happened on Shania again. And the interesting thing is, back at Mercury, we had we created this marketing campaign called the Triple Play marketing, you know, Triple Play. And it was three artists. We were going to bring all three artists on the road, go to radio stations, try to break three artists at the same time, right? Mm-hmm. So those three artists were Shania Twain, Toby Keith, and a guy named John Brannon. And so we went out, they would sit on stools and they would play their songs with acoustic guitars and all these radio stations. And everybody thought, oh my gosh, John Brannon, he's the guy. Like, he's the guy. He was great. But it wasn't meant to be for John Brannon because, you know, obviously Toby, you know, went on too. We had a song called, the first single was Should Have Been a Cowboy. And, you know, it was a three-chord song, just this really great song, rocketed all the way to number one. And that's the way things would happen back then. Like, songs would take off, and you'd get a streak of number ones going. And so Toby was off and running, right? And John Brannon just didn't – I don't know where he went. You know, it just kind of didn't happen for him. It wasn't his time. But that was amazing in itself, that whole concept of triple playing. Out of those three artists come two superstars. I mean, you know, you could – there's no way that would happen today. Yeah. You can't, you know, there's what, 100,000 songs released a day on the DSPs. You know, people put out every day. You know, people are putting music out, and it's just, it's so diluted now that you can't identify a star. And it's really hard to identify. There's great songs, but the longevity of those songs is hard to, or careers is hard to build.
So what was it like doing that sort of push into the radio stations? I mean, there's a lot of mythology around, you know, payola and what you'd have to do to get a record played on a radio station.
Yeah, you know, interesting. I remember back in the, was the 50s or something when, you know, the guys, the promo guys would go to the record station and they'd give them a 45, and inside the 45 would be like a $100 bill. Right. You know, here's my new single, you know, and right. Walk away and, you know, oh, it'd appear on the radio the next day. But, you know, those, the laws were, you know, they cracked down on that stuff, and it was, you know, but it still existed. You know, the promo angle was really fun because just being a promo guy and going to the stations with the artists, when you had a brand new artist, you know, the radio stations were very receptive. They wanted to see that artist because they knew things were happening. They knew that the industry was, you know, blossoming and things were happening. So they didn't know. They were like, oh, who's this now? Who's this next guy? You know, and so when you had an artist that had, you know, hit rolling like Billy Ray Cyrus, you'd bring him in and people would flip out. You know, the whole radio station would come in and everybody would be there. There'd be people outside the building wanting his autograph. It was that environment. And so that was, it was fun. It was a lot of fun to be involved in that and to ride that momentum, you know, because off of that, as a promotion guy, you just make other stuff happen. You got a new artist over here. You got Billy Ray Cyrus over here. Well, hey, listen to this new guy, because I'm telling you, he's got it. And they would believe you, you know, and it was really fun. It was a good time.
And that was back, I would think, it's a lot different now. Those were independent radio stations, right? I mean, now, what, there's a couple companies that own all the radio stations? So is the industry the same where you're still marketing to individual stations, or are you, like, hitting the big guys at the top and hoping it trickles down?
Yeah, back then there was a number of groups owned a lot of radio stations, and it has consolidated into majors owning a lot of them. You know, iHeartRadio, Cumulus, you know, these things, these stations, these companies own the lion's share of these radio stations and control a lot of those radio stations. And I think, you know, what they do now is they definitely look for the hits that are being driven on the DSP side. You know, they want to have the research. They want to know that they have a hit. The magic back then is you didn't have that. You might have had, you know, just this emotional draw and this belief, you know, this trust that this artist is happening. You know, believe me, we can feel this. This is, you know, this feels like a hit. You know, the word hit, really interesting. I use that term a lot, you know, just what defines a hit. Well, you know, nowadays a hit is research. A hit, you know, a hit in my mind is a radio song, is a radio, you know, big monster radio song. But that's back then was the magical part of that. You could have these guys believe that you've got something going on, as opposed to today, where it's, you know, very metric driven, right?
I mean, you could really have a hit without ever being on the radio these days, right?
True. That's exactly right. Yeah, in terms of you know, there was a couple of years ago, I mean, on TikTok, you know, these young artists would put out a song and it would blow up, and they would manufacture it themselves and it would just blow up. And then the major record companies were signing those artists to these deals, these big advances, you know, paying them, I don't know, $1 million, you know, to sign. And they'd try to ride the wave on that song as long as they could. But then, unfortunately, there's not a lot of artist development, so then they would be dropping the artist. So then it's a, you know, it's a chase for revenue, right? It's a mad dash to get as much money as they can out of that hit. But yeah, to your point, they just did it themselves. There wasn't any touring. There's, you know, it's just this viral hit.
And Nashville is a town, so you spent, what, 30 years there? How?
A long time. Yeah, probably.
How 86. Has it changed?
Well, you can't drive anywhere. It's a little crazy in the traffic. Back then, you know, I moved there in 86, and if you go downtown to Broadway, it was actually scary. You didn't want to go down there because there wasn't anybody down there, and it was dangerous, right? Now it's like Las Vegas. It's like the strip on Las Vegas, right? And all the traffic around town is, I think there's been a lot of influx of people moving there from LA, New York, music business stuff, but, you know, insurance business, there are many businesses there, but there's no state tax for income there. So I think a lot of these people from LA, you know, big producers would move there and they'd buy a chunk of land, you know, in Franklin down, you know, south. And now that's not so much, you know, it's pretty saturated now, but I don't know, 10 years ago, it was that way where there was a lot of people coming in, a lot of music business people coming in. And, you know, but it's changed tremendously. Yeah, there's the music business is still there and it still operates and labels are still there and Music Row is still there where, you know, Music Row is two streets, 16th, 17th, that go about a mile down each way. They're one-way streets. And on those, you know, on those streets are these, you know, again, iconic publishing houses and record companies and artist management places and, you know, all these places that have existed for years where the lion's share of the music business was driven from. Now Universal and Sony and all that, you know, they have buildings downtown. They have, you know, there's a lot of big buildings going up and they have floors of these buildings with people, you know. So it's changed, you know, into the corporate, you know, realm more than it was in some old house back then. When I worked for Mercury, it was in this old four square. Like we were just, you know, we had offices and the bedrooms and stuff, and it was just great, you know.
So tell me some stories about some of these artists. Let me see. Like you toured with Billy Ray Cyrus for a long time. He had quite a career, and I think the last thing I saw him do was a bit embarrassing the other day.
Yeah.
Got any good stories about Billy on the road?
Yeah, it was a fun time back then watching the rise of Billy Ray on the road. Fans would literally, he'd pull up in a car outside of a hotel and they'd all be waiting for him. You know, it's just the classic kind of Beatles thing where, you know, you got a rock star superstar there. So that was interesting seeing all of that. But being on the road with different artists, it was a learning experience in terms of how much it takes to put together a show, a concert, a radio tour. You know, several weeks of a radio tour on a bus. I did a lot of that. I did that with Shania, did it with a number of different bands. That was my job at Mercury. I was really, you know, head of artist development. So back then you would really be with the artists a lot on the road. And you got to know them. You got to, you know, dig into their psyche and see what drives them and see how they create and see, you know, see them on stage and how they perform and really that sense of what does it take to have your energy go out and have people receive that energy, you know, and then the difference between good energy and bad energy, because that would happen. And the trap that artists fall into is that trap of stardom, right? They buy into the stardom and they buy into the persona when they're walking down the street and everybody's noticing them and wants their autograph. They buy into that. So then they think they don't have to do any work and they think that they've arrived and they become soft and their energy changes. And so the ones that really are successful keep driving forward with positive energy and with this work ethic. And because people look at them, you know, people watch what they do and what they do matters. And so you create that momentum, you create that synergy, and you create that space. And it's interesting to be in that and see that happen or see it not happen, you know, both ways, and then try to figure out, And then at the end of the day, it's always about the music, right? It's always about the music. Like they would say in Nashville, you can't polish a turd, which means that, you know, these guys would come to town with their songs and, hey, man, let's hire a bunch of these A musicians, studio guys. And these studio guys would go ahead and they'd make it sound like $1 million, but it would still be a turd. It's not a great song, right? And so that was interesting. You know, you'd hear a lot of things that sounded good, but they're not great songs. So at the end of the day, it really takes something special, you know, creatively, a song that can last, that can be out there.
What about Johnny Cash? I remember, I think it was in Chicago, you invited me to a show when I was quite young, and we got to hang out in his bus. Mm. What a sweet guy. You got any good Johnny Cash story?
Yeah, that's one right there. That was a great night. I remember that. What I remember about that is he was playing at the Cubby Bear in Chicago with June, his wife, and his band. And it was at the time I told you that, you know, he was ready to be dropped. He wasn't, he was just out touring. He was doing his thing. He was Johnny Cash. But he was still iconic to us, right? He was Johnny Cash, but he wasn't, you know, what he was going to be, you know, but...
Or what he had been.
Right.
Right? That, I mean, this was a tiny club.
That's true. That's exactly true. What he had been is a really good point. So I remember when we were sitting in the bus, we were waiting for him in a tour bus. If people don't know, you know, you walk into this tour bus, you've probably seen him on the road, but you walk in the front door and you turn and you see the front lounge and there's maybe a couch on the right, couch on the left, a little table, a fridge, all this stuff. And there's a door about mid-bus and it goes back. And right when you open that door, there's a series of bunks, probably three bunks on either side. And in the very back, there's another door. And in the back of the bus is usually where the main artists will stay. They'll stay back there. That's their bed and the whole thing. So we came in. We were sitting in the front waiting for him. That mid-door was shut. And it was kind of dark in the bus, the low lighting. And I'll never forget this because he opened the door and he kind of stood in the door. And from the back, there was lights. And so he was backlit. So we saw this. For the moment, in my brain, I was this shadow of Johnny Cash before he stepped into the light. But I would just I'd never forget that. I was like, wow. And then he was very gracious, and we took some photos, which we still have, and they're great. And, yeah, it was a special night. He was, you know, he actually, I tried to do a lot of promo for him. I wanted to work with him. I wanted to get this single Wanted Man going, and so I would ask... I would call his office, and again, back then, not like today, his niece answered the phone or something in the management office, and I'd have a conversation with her, you know, can he do some promo for me? Can he sign some, you know, autograph some posters I can send to radio station, something? And, you know, he did some of that, but he was always very busy, and I think his mother was sick, and some things were happening, so he couldn't get around to some. And then... you know, a week or two later, I received a letter in the mail. It was a handwritten note from Johnny Cash that I have framed, but it was, you know, "Dear Norbert, I can't do any promo now, you know, due to my mother's sick, you know, critical condition, and, you know, looking forward to meeting you, you know, when you in Nashville," all this, you know, this nice little, you know, couple paragraph letter. And I was like, man, I thought, you know, at the time, okay, hey, man, that's great. And now I look at it and I'm like, oh my God, that's incredible, you know? Handwritten letter by Johnny Cash. But that was fun. I mean, I was, again, really fortunate to be in the middle of all that. It was just I found my way, man, and it just happened. It was pretty incredible.
And we are going to take a break for Station ID. And this is Conversations, a one-hour interview show heard every Thursday here on WDRT 91.9. And we'll be back. Welcome back to Conversations on WDRT. My guest today is my brother, Norbert Nix, talking about recollections of the music industry, being a musician, how things have changed, Nashville, La Crosse. So you have moved back to La Crosse to our hometown after all these years living in Nashville and Los Angeles and different places. How's that treating you?
Well, I love it. I think it's great. We recently sold our house in Nashville, and we have been there a long time. We raised our kids there, you know, had careers there, and would always come back here. We had a house. We've had a house here for a number of years. And, you know, every time I'd come back, it's holidays, family. I see you. You know, I see all our brothers and sisters and our friends and family. And we always loved that. And so we recently just made the decision we're just going to live here because we love it here. And I'm, you know, again, semi-retired, I call it. But I'm not involved in the music business in Nashville anymore. So, you know, peripherally I am, but I don't need to be there. So we love it here. We love it here. I skied all winter. Mm. Last time I skied was a long time ago, and I got a membership and went out to Mount La Crosse, and it's phenomenal. They do a great job out there. They had a lot of snow. They, you know, a lot of people out there skiing that I knew. So yeah, we're here. We love it.
Yeah, and you not only are a skier, but you're a triathlonist, Ironman.
Oh my gosh!
How you spent a lot of time doing that? What was that like? Or what is it like?
You should ask my wife. No, I tell you what, it takes a lot of time. The Ironman thing is just crazy. Triathlons are quite the discipline, you know, three disciplines, actually, swimming, biking, and running. So it's like you have to learn three different disciplines and kind of piece them together. But that, for me, you know, I like jumping around and learning different things. But yeah, it's phenomenal. It kind of pushes your whole boundary of what you think you can do and can't do. And, you know, levels of pain and all of that endurance, but it's kind of fun, man. It's, at the end of the day, it's like anything else in life. Once you accomplish something of great magnitude, you have a different perspective on what's tough and what's not tough, you know? So yeah, I do that. I just, at this point in my life, man, it's just trying to be fit, you know, maybe go walking with the dog and my wife down the street, and that's, you know.
Well, putting your musician hat back on, who were your heroes growing up and now? I know you have a fetish for Led Zeppelin and The Who. Did you ever get to meet any of these guys and, you know, like my hero kind of moment?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question because all along in the music business, you meet all these artists that other people would love to meet, right? And I would think nothing of it, but in terms of, yes, I've met Robert Plant one time backstage. He signed a concert ticket for me, and I would love to meet Pete Townshend. And to me, that would be the big, you know, the big one, you know, Jimmy Page, all that stuff. Yeah. You know, look, those guys are legendary to me because I grew up listening to that music, and that's really what influenced me. That's what I remember growing up listening to these albums, you know, in the house in 2525 Main Street, you know, on the record player and just listening to all that and going, what is that? What is that sound? So yeah, you know, Eddie today becoming Led Zeppelin is playing at the Rivoli. It's finally here. It's all over the country. It just got into La Crosse, but this apparently is this movie with, you know, all this footage that nobody's ever seen. It's this great documentary on Led Zeppelin. So I think we need to go to that. I think we need to find our way.
I think that's a good idea.
Yeah.
So what else do you want to accomplish in your life, in your musical career, or you're working now with something that's completely outside of the country music realm or even the rock and roll realm, which is more pop music, electronic, this guy Sawyer, Utah. How'd you find him?
You know, my sister Mary Kay, our sister Mary Kay, several years ago, probably 7 years ago now, asked me when I was in La Crosse if I would listen to some music by a young man who went to school with her son, to Logan. And I said, sure. So she gave me, or connected me with the mother, and he sent some music. And I listened to it, and I immediately thought, okay, here's a 17-year-old kid with sense of composition, a sense of performance. He can do all the instruments. He's got a great voice. He's got a great sense of engineering. He's a master on Logic Pro. He can engineer, he can produce. He's got all these components that, again, back in the 70s, if you wrote the song, okay, well, then you got to go to the studio. You got to hire musicians. You got to do all that stuff, right? And he did it all. And then he did it on a, you know, MacBook Pro. And then when it's done, it's ready to send out into the world. So I thought, okay. So I started talking to him, and then he sent me a couple songs. And I said to him, there was a moment when there was a song, and I said, okay, look, the chorus sounds like the verse. Can you change the chorus? The chorus needs to lift. Can you bring it to a point where, you know? And within an hour, he sent me back a complete revision of this thing, and it was changed to the point where it was fantastic, like the chorus lifted. And so I knew that he could take direction and, you know, do all that. And so we work together now for 7 years. I have a publishing company that I've established for him and a record company that I've got to deal with, The Orchard. And, you know, we have this business model going on. He's a hard worker. He goes on the road. He tours. He does, you know, he's written 300 songs in the last 6 years in the catalog. And we've got major label cuts. We've got production going on with different artists all over the country. Yes, it's different than what I do as a pop artist. So he leans pop. He's, you know, Charlie Puth, these kinds of artists, you know, he aspires to be these producer artists. So we go to LA, go to New York, we go to Nashville. He lives in Nashville with an artist named Zach Hood, who's on Arista Records, who is a pop artist that he's probably going to produce his own next record. So that space, he's 23 years old now, and I just draw on that energy. I just draw on that energy. We get on the phone and we just go over it, man. And it's so fun. You know, going back to step one, like, right, creating this thing out of nothing, trying to make something happen and not, you know, not going, well, I know this guy and that, just trying to just, you know, get you, you know, up by your bootstraps, man. Let's try to make this thing happen. It's a lot different because I know a lot of things to do now, where back then I didn't really know that.
So what inspires you now? Like, where does, when you go into the studio or you try to write a song or you get up on stage, is there a way to describe where that inspiration and energy comes from for you?
Yes. Well, I'm not supposed to do this, but I'm going to say you inspire me. And you do. I'm not kidding. I mean, all the things you've done is incredible to see, you know, what you've done in your million books and whatever it is. It's, you know, we inspire each other, and it's always good to see, you know, back when you were a kid, I'd bring you up to Minneapolis to do your acting. You're a great, you know, theater guy. And we've always been back and forth on the art stuff, you and I, you know. And so we find that, you know, you invited me here, and, you know, Eddie invites me into the studio. I don't know what we're going to talk about. But that's Eddie, and he knew what he was going to talk about. So anyway, this is great. I love that this inspires me. So what inspires me is just, at this point, staying young, being inspired, listening to music. And, you know, like right now we're rehearsing the Phoenix stuff. We're going to start rehearsing. So I have a studio set up where I've got, you know, this sound coming out through headphones now. And, you know, we got this different routine and a different approach and new songs and this energy when you get on stage, you know, to know that, you know, you can still do this. You can still, you know, light up the guitar and play it and sing, and people appreciate it. And especially around here, this area is so great. There's a lot of great bands doing this, you know, still doing it after years and years and years. These guys are still up there doing it. It's so fun. So that's what I love about it.
And, you know, in Phoenix, of course, Dan Sobranek, who you mentioned you played with Bill Miller, and you've played with for the last 50 years, always amazing to see. You guys have a good story. You got a good story about growing up and, you know, being 18 in a rock band in La Crosse, some stupid thing you did.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Dan's still doing it. Dan is, you know, one of these people, too, that when he plays his music and he plays around here frequently, his song list is just incredible. You know, the songs that he plays on his list, you know, his repertoire is great. He plays all sorts of different things. But he and I have been friends forever. And I guess when you ask about inspiring, the thing that's inspiring too is when we get together, he and I, and I'll join him on stage somewhere, wherever he's playing, we just click into what we know. And we start just going forward. We know each other intuitively. I know what he's going to do. He knows what I'm going to do. And we play these songs and we go over these things that we've been playing for years, and it just clicks. That's the beauty of knowing him for so long as a friend, but also musically, is that we take each other's lead, and There's nothing like it. You know, there's nothing like being connected musically like that to somebody. That's a great thing.
Yeah, yeah. So what's next? Is there a next thing you want to work on, or, you know, do you feel you've accomplished what you want to do, or
no?
You got a bucket list?
I'm not done, man. I don't know what the bucket list is. I've done a lot of things, but you know, I'd like to play some more music around here. I'd like to maybe do a solo, you know, set, you know, play some songs, piano. I play some piano, and you know, get out and play some of these places, which is a really tough thing to do, you know. So,
well, Verroque was a hard, you know, community to play.
A tough one to break into.
Yeah.
Tough market.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, you know, look, I mean, I just think being creative, you know, and being back here, it's just great to see all the people that I know. And, you know, we were hanging the other night, you know, being with family, being with friends. And we would always be in Nashville and we'd be thinking, oh, you know, we're missing this or we're missing that. You know, too bad we can't be there for that. And now we're here. So we just randomly call you or, you know, call the family and we say, hey, come to the house or we'll come to your house and we'll, you know, we'll just hang out together, man. And that's kind of what's the beauty of right now, the present time now, you know, be here now, right?
Perfect.
Yeah.
Oh, tell me a little bit, since we don't have much time left, about... You were mentioning being on the road with some of these guys and ladies and how either they capture the spirit of creativity and they work with their stardom or else they don't, you know, they blow it. What do you think if you were talking to an aspiring musician, would you have any advice for them?
Yes, I would. I would have advice. I would say... and you know, before I would give any advice, look, it's up to me to give him advice. I can, but the thing is, I think it comes from the person. I think when you know, you can read the room pretty quick on somebody who's an artist, younger artist, and they, you know, the mindset of that artist. Sawyer was a good example. He always had the positive attitude and wanted to work. You know, some of these people think that it's just a show, right? I mean, they want to be a star. And I get that. You know, that's why these television shows exist. They just want to be a star, and they think that that's what this is all about. And that, you know, then you can't give them any advice because it doesn't matter what you tell them. They just, it won't happen. That's why it's so few and far between to find people who are dedicated to the craft who can make the long run, because it's not going to be easy. If you want to dedicate your life to this, there's no plan B. It's got to be a plan A. You know, don't quit your day job, all that stuff. It's not easy. It's a very tough road. So I feel really fortunate to be working with Sawyer, you know, working with him and having this young energy, you know, force field that, in my opinion, has a great chance to make it because of the attitude. So I think you can read the room on that. I think you can talk to these people, these artists, and see where their heads are at, you know. Not that they can't learn it, but it takes a lot of work. I mean, I would just say dedicate yourself and be inspired, right?
I think so. You raised two kids. They're both adults now, into college and out of college. And how was that experience? And
well, I should have done it. No, we're good. You know, look, I got started late. So my kids are 21 and 23 and wouldn't do it any other way. My kids are great. They both go to college. My daughter's in Florence, Italy, going to, you know, textile design, master's degree. My son's in Knoxville going in sports management. They're both inspired. My wife drives the whole thing. She is, you know, just sends this love, you know, big love out to them. And they, you know, we have a great family vibe and a chemistry going, and that's what we like. We're in a good space right now. And you know, so we just hope for them that they can do great things, and that those great things are about being good people and doing good things for people, you know, and that's the essence of what we need to do today. You know, that's what needs to happen today, you know, more than ever it needs to happen. You need to be a good person. You need to be having that positive energy flow, right? I mean, it's all about that, and it's not easy to do. I'm not saying I'm Mr. Positive, you know, on the contrary, man, but it's just really important to be thinking like that, right? And so, it's good having young kids, at my age. I mean, I'm 67, and it's like I if I did this 20 years ago, I don't think I'd have the advice I have now, which I'm have more advice to give them. Sometimes they don't want to hear it, though.
Imagine that.
They don't like it so much, but no.
So now you get to geek out in your little studio in your basement, and you're learning, like, these computer programs. What is it, Logic Pro or Pro Tools? How is that to sort of transform from more of a, I guess, analog, career to being really into the digital? You enjoying it?
Yeah, I love it. I used to do it. I had a studio before I was married, kind of the first incarnation of studio, with ADAT, 8-tracks, and, these, kind of UHS looking tapes, digital tapes, and all the outboard gear, that we had in a rack. And I did a lot of that back then, did a lot of recording. And but now, when you look at the Logic Pro and all the programs in there, it's great for my brain to keep, going and learn this stuff. But there's hundreds and hundreds of these outboard, gear, these little racks that you could have in the computer. There's everything you want. You don't need anything else. It's all in the computer. So it's fascinating to see the depth of what they've done and how, I don't know how they do it, but the sounds are just incredible. So yeah, I'm having a lot of fun, and I guess that's one of my big goals, is to make more music, make more music and keep making music and keep maybe bringing in people like Dan Sperronic and making an EP on him and, making music for people around the area.
So final question, we're down to the wire. If you had to choose musicians from either the past that are dead or present to put together a super band to be able to play one night, who would it be?
Well, we got 1 minute, so that's not going to happen in a minute. But, oh, my gosh. I don't know, man. That's a tough one. I'd probably have probably the Hallelujah Choir, like, with all these people, right? It'd be like 30 of them, right, singing, probably directing an a cappella.
Exactly.
Whether they can sing or not, they're just all going to sing with their voices. Yeah.
What a beautiful thought. Well, this has been Conversations. I've been talking to my older brother, Norbert Nix, who you can see play in the band Phoenix coming up. What, Moon Tunes? What?
Moon Tunes with the Remainders in August, I think it is. I don't know the exact date.
That's in La Crosse
or something.
At Riverside Park. Thanks a lot for coming in, man. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, us?
Yeah, I don't know. No, me.
Yes.
Good being with you, my brother.
All right. Thanks.
Yeah. Much love.